It sounds like you're just like stepping on crunchy leaves. Oh, dude, it was so satisfying.
Welcome to episode 86, where we talk about the spooky Green Knight.
Ooh. In 1 year hence.
Joined by the all-knowing Sheldon Fogel.
Hello.
And the incredible lyricist and philosopher, Anthony Clarkson.
Good evening.
So, let's get into it. We saw this movie. Sheldon and I saw it together. You saw it by yourself.
Yes.
And it's been something that you've been wanting to talk about. So, yeah, man, let's talk about it.
Yeah, so Green Knight came out through A24. And as you guys know, I'm a huge A24 fan. And then I saw the trailer for this movie. I was like, wow, this is super exciting. And then it was slated to come out earlier, and then COVID came out. However, Ronnie, my brother, who's seen the movie, and then we saw it again together, he was telling me that it was not only COVID, but it was, I think his name is David Lowery, the mm-hmm. filmmaker who made it, who also made another A24 one called The Ghost Story. I don't know if you guys ever saw that one, but that's a different topic. But anyway, Ronnie was telling me that it got pushed back because the movie was not in his like vision. He wanted to rework it. So I think it was like a mix between that and COVID, which made it more delayed than it was. But yeah, totally worth the wait.
I don't mean to sidetrack anyone, but is it just me or like there's consistencies within A24 films? Like there's always goats or farm animals. Mm-hmm. Like I feel like that's a big thing.
Very thematic.
In all of them.
They always have like a certain theme that they like, or allegorical reference. And like a lot of A24 movies that I notice as well.
But Midsommar, there's goats. Yeah. This movie, it opens up with like shots and close-ups of farm animals.
Was Hereditary A24?
Hereditary was A24. That's another like thing with like goats and farm animals. Is that just because like goats and farm animals are inherently kind of spooky? Or is that just like the calling card of this studio? I was trying to figure that out.
I don't know, but I think before we go into that or like, we talk more about A24, we have to, and I'm sure you guys, we already know, is that they're just the distribution company. So they pick the movie. They don't make the movies. They just pick them and put them out. So
but a lot of their
record label.
A lot of their films do typically.
I'm serious.
No, people, it's so many people like say that. Yeah. They're like, oh, they always make Fire, like this, that, and the other thing. It's like, well, and I thought that too. Like, I always thought they're the ones that make it. And then I learned that they're just like.
So why do they pick things?
But ironically, a lot of their films have a very similar like aesthetic.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, there's a very similar, like, you know it's an A24 film when you see it. But I think I have a theory of why they use, like, goats and lambs. Because, like, a lamb is a biblical tale of, like, Jesus Christ and stuff like that. Wasn't a lamb or, like, a sheep or something like that?
Yeah, it's sometimes
like
the symbology
of symbolic
Jesus,
for the birth of Christ, right?
Yeah.
So if we, like, think of the movies. So Hereditary, it was, like, the lamb because the birth of, like, that demon.
Okay.
Was coming. The daughter who ends up, spoiler, who ends up passing away, and then like her essence and then her mother and like that cult, they eventually were trying to bring the leader back. So maybe that was a reference on Midsommar. I don't remember. I remember a bear being a big reference point for that one.
Oh, yeah.
Towards the end.
The boyfriend,
yeah. And then what's the Goat Boy? What's it called?
Lamb.
Lamb. That's coming out that we saw that in the trailer. We were like, what's the date? Because we're coming right back.
Half the people were like laughing hysterically watching this trailer, and then the other half was like, I can't wait until this comes out.
For the 2 minutes that trailer was on, I didn't notice until literally the last 30 seconds that it was half lamb, half boy.
Mm-hmm.
Until like it was holding the woman's hand, and I was like, oh. Because I was like, why? I didn't understand what was going on. And then it finally, I was starting to unravel the pieces a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm willing to bet that Lamb is that character that's like the Lamb child is the product of someone's mind. I'm not sure if it's going to be too literal of a character as in an actual literal Lamb boy, but nonetheless, it looked pretty interesting.
Yeah, dude, when she was walking with that thing, I was like, okay, what is going on here?
Yeah,
how
like I
did
said,
this happen?
What is the obsession with farm animals? That, and I feel like A24 films all have an intense knowledge of typography. There's always like some sort of crazy font, very Tarantino-esque, that just like sprawls across the screen or is present somewhere. In this film, it's like almost like the opening of a Looney Tune cartoon, like how prominent the titles are for like
each
chapter.
The scenes. Yeah.
And that's like something that was present in Inglourious Basterds a lot, you know? And I think, what was the one about Slavery with Jamie Foxx?
Django.
Yeah,
Django.
I think there was a lot of the same kind of use of fonts and typography.
But it's good that A24 is getting that repertoire because you know I'm a massive Chris Nolan fan. So whenever his film distribution, Syncopy, have a film come out, like that one that we saw the trailer of, I'm like, I'm there. So when you see that A24 tagline for Ant, he's like, I'm there.
Right.
Like it's that's what you kind of, you want to have like a trusted distribution where it's not like, you know, like Miramax or Universal that makes all these films under one umbrella and then like you can pick and choose. You kind of know what you're getting, like Syncopy, they do, it's like Time. Or like Bad Robot with J.J. Abrams, you know it's going to be some sci-fi-esque, you know, kaiju film in a sense, because he loves that. So it's like, you're getting that trusted brand. So when you see A24, you know that you're going to get something that's not just surface level. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a little bit past. It's going to make you think you're going to, that replay value with these A24 films is like unreal. Because I've seen Hereditary, I think, two times. I've seen Midsommar two or three times. I've only seen Green Knight once so far, but I'm definitely going to see it again because I still remember there was that one shot in the film that it happened so fast when the camera was tilting at, as our main character was walking after the Land of Giants. Then there was a split second. Something popped on the screen. I missed it. And like I still haven't wanted to like go online to figure out what it was, but I like that there's always like Easter eggs and, you know, the viewer, your eyes, you need to fully pay attention. I like to be engaged with a film.
Yeah.
And not just like, you know, mindless summer blockbuster sometimes, but sometimes those are good.
Yeah, that's the thing with A24. It's like they are like the like a mainstream art house production company. Because for more art house and artsy movies, you have to like kind of seek them out. But with A24, they're bringing it to the mainstream. They're bringing it to the theaters. So like that's what's super cool about them. They're
it's
like,
rare.
They're, yeah, it's totally rare. It's rare. Like the Miramax of art house films.
Yeah.
But the one point you brought up, it's like, what was Chris Nolan's studio name? Did you say?
I think it's Syncopy.
Syncopy.
I think it's Syncopy.
Syncopy, you were saying, I'm going to be there. If it's A24, Ant's going to be there. It's A24, they do put out like a lot of good stuff, but A24, they put out like two of the worst movies I've ever seen. The one was The Bling Ring, which is probably the worst movie I've ever seen. And then...
but what year was this?
This was 2013, 2014.
Okay, so it wasn't recent. Yeah.
It was the true story of those kids that like party in the Hollywood Hills and then they go into like the stars' homes and like steal like their jewelry and shoes and stuff like that. It was the crappiest movie I've ever seen.
It's funny because it sounds like the premise would be like pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah, but it was done so poorly. It was written and directed by... I forget her first name. But it's Francis Ford Coppola's daughter. And it was just a really bad movie. Emma Watson was in it too. She was smoking hot. And the other one was a scary movie. It was called Black Coat's Daughter. And it was just very bad.
Black Coat's Daughter. I don't think I've ever seen that.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Forget I even said it.
Lighthouse was A24, right?
It was, yeah. It was Eggers. So Eggers also did The Witch and The Lighthouse. And then his next one is The Northman, which is not coming out through A24. But Witch and Lighthouse are both A24 movies. Probably two of my favorite movies. Very, very good stuff. And also two movies that go back to that animal theme. So in The Witch, you have Black Phillip, the goat, again a goat. And then in The Lighthouse, you have the sequel. It's Bad Luck to Kill a Gull.
I'm checking also to see what other films like A24 has done. They're fairly new, only since 2014.
And yeah, I thought it was 2012.
Yeah, they have a lot.
They got Uncut Gems, Good Time. They have one called Florida Project. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that one. That's one of the best movies I've ever seen.
Is that with the it's on Netflix, right?
It is on Netflix.
A single mother.
Yeah.
Prostitute.
No, I don't recall her being a prostitute. She's just like a. I don't know like the correct term to use, but she's just like a.
I heard it was good. I think Chris Sipple told me about it.
I highly recommend it. Might have been you. So in Italian cinema, they kind of like pioneered the term neorealisms, and neorealism films are just like a slice of life, like real life, like, you know, like nothing too crazy. Just this is life. This is what's going on. And the way that they did it in like a ghetto, I put that in quotes. I'm like a kind of rundown motel in Florida. And you're seeing like that life through children's eyes, and you see their innocence like they're trying to maintain their innocence while like all this stuff's going on. It is done and shot so well. And that's another thing about A24 movies too, that I also noticed that they do. They always look for good cinematography.
They did American Honey. I love that movie.
I didn't see that one.
With Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, shoot. I got to see that
one. That's on Netflix. That's a really good movie too. That's such a good movie. Yeah, they have an expansive list. They have so many films.
And they got some good ones coming up too. So Ari Aster is the guy that made Hereditary and Midsommar, and the next one he has coming out is called Disappointment Boulevard, and it's got Joaquin Phoenix in it. And I thought it was a drama, but apparently it's going to be like a scary drama or something like that. So that one I'm super excited for.
They did a movie. I didn't know this was A24, and this fits the art house thing they were saying. I told Drew about this film years ago that they did. I didn't know they did. It's one of my favorite like psychological horror films. It's called Climax. It takes place in France.
Oh, Sheldon. Oh, my gosh. Yes, dude. Yes. Yeah,
that movie's incredible.
It's crazy. It's like it's all like one shot. So, dude, this is like the premise of the movie. So, it's in French, and it's like younger kids, I guess like kind of our age, and they love dancing, and then they go to this warehouse.
And they're doing a celebration.
Yeah, and they're just like, just dancing, but then like someone puts something in like punch, and dude, it all goes downhill. Someone spikes a
sangria with LSD, and everyone drinks it. And so they're all experiencing, you know, their own type of trip, and it's all one shot. So one person will be freaking out, then you're like following them on their trip, and then it blends in with another person, and then the camera goes with them to someone else, and it's like, dude, it is visceral, and it typical A24 fashion, very like the mood with the lights, like a lot of red, a lot of like blue, and like how they did with the Green Knight. Like one of my favorite shots is when the Green Knight came in and then he gave the letter, and then a red light shined on King Arthur's like right hand man, we'll say, and then had the green light on his wife as she was reading the letter with the Green Knight's voice. Two things I really love. Yeah, it was dope.
Totally.
Yeah. Real quick before we like hop into the movie, I actually wanted to read like the original Green Knight story. More importantly, where it deviates from the movie, because there's actually a huge difference. I'm not sure if you guys like ever did you do you know about this?
I did know about it. I actually went to the library the other day to get a copy of it, but they didn't have it, and I got a movie instead.
Apparently, it's uncredited, right?
It's just like Beowulf. Like it's so old that the person who wrote it just didn't credit themselves. Yeah. But there's been so many iterations of it, so I'll run through it real quick. Excuse me, as I'm probably gonna mess up a lot. In Camelot on New Year's Eve, King Arthur's court is exchanging gifts and waiting for the feasting to start. When the king sees and hears of an exciting adventure, a gigantic figure entirely green in appearance and riding a green horse rides unexpectedly into the hall. He wears no armor and bears an axe in one hand and a holy bow in the other, refusing to fight anyone there on the grounds that they are all too weak to take him on. He insists he has come in one hand for a friendly Christmas game. Someone is to strike him once with an axe on the condition that the Green Knight may return the blow in a year and a day. The splendid axe will belong to whoever accepts the deal. Arthur himself is prepared to accept the challenge when it appears no other knight will dare, but Sir Gawain, youngest of Arthur's knights and his nephew, asks for the honor instead. The giant bends and bares his neck before him, and Gawain neatly beheads him in one stroke. However, the Green Knight neither falls nor falters, but instead reaches out, picks up a severed head, and remounts, holding up his bleeding head to Queen Guinevere, while its writhing lips remind Gawain that two must meet again at the Green Chapel. He then rides away. Gawain and Arthur admire the axe, hang it up as a trophy, and encourage Guinevere to treat the whole matter lightly. So as the date approaches, I'll probably just, you know, let me just skip to the part that's like actually really different. So this is the part with the sash, which is like a big thing in the movie. So we're at the mansion now. The next day, the lady comes again. Gawain again courteously foils her advances, and later that day, there is a similar exchange of a hunted boar for two kisses. She comes once more in the third morning, but once her advances are denied, she offers Gawain a gold ring as a keepsake. He gently but steadfastly, refuses, but she pleads that he at least take her sash, a girdle of green and gold silk. The sash, the lady assures him, is charmed and will keep him from all physical harm. Tempted as he may otherwise die the next day, Gawain accepts it, and they exchange three kisses. The lady has Gawain swear that he will keep the gift secret from her husband. That evening, the lord returns with a fox, which he exchanges with Gawain for the three kisses, but Gawain says nothing of the sash. This is where it's different. The next day, Gawain binds the sash around his waist at the so-called Green Chapel, only an earthen mound. He finds the Green Knight sharpening an axe, promise... Gawain, okay, so as promised, Gawain bends his bare neck to receive his blow. At the first swing, Gawain flinches slightly, and the Green Knight belittles him for it. Ashamed of himself, Gawain doesn't flinch with the second swing, but again, the Green Knight withholds the full force of the blow. The knight explains he was testing Gawain's nerve. Angrily, Gawain tells him to deliver his blow so the knight does, causing only a slight wound on Gawain's neck. The game is over. Gawain seizes his sword, helmet, and shield, but the Green Knight, laughing, reveals himself to be none other than the Lord of the Castle, Bertok the Haudeset, whatever his name is. Transformed by magic, he explains that the entire adventure was a trick of the elderly lady Gawain saw in the castle, the person who was blindfolded in the movie.
It turns out to be his mother.
Yeah, who was actually the sorceress Morgan Le Fay, Arthur's stepsister, who intended to... Did you read this already?
Yeah. Because I was so curious after we saw the film.
Yeah, me too. All right, yeah. So for people who are curious...
No, keep going,
like,
for the audience.
Oh, yeah. So intended to... I'm doing a terrible job. So sister who intended to test King Arthur's knights and frighten Guinevere to death. The nick Arthur suffered in the third stroke was because of his attempt to conceal the gift of the sash. Gawain is ashamed to have behaved deceitfully, but the Green Knight laughs and professes him the most blameless knight in all the land. The two part on cordial terms. Gawain returns to Camelot wearing the sash as a token of his failure to keep his promise. The knights of the Round Table absolve him of blame and decide that henceforth each will wear a green sash in recognition of Gawain's adventure and as a reminder to always be honest. So it's all a big guffaw. It's all a big joke in the original.
It's
a ruse.
The sheep's wools over your eyes.
Yeah, which I think like doesn't make as compelling as a story of, as what this movie is. You know?
Yeah,
that's
really
it
great.
Right there.
That's really good.
Yeah. Because
I'm not saying, that's like not bad or anything. It's still a good story, but...
Because think of it as an audience, you're watching this film, and then like it's just like a haha at the end of the movie. Like, there was no threat the whole time. Like, if it was like that poem. So how he changed it, I think, makes a better ending.
And also, it's just like
the story of
Gawain.
He was
transformed by magic. So, like, you know, he gets his head cut off, and that had like no consequence. Yep. But at the end, like, he's suddenly like back to it. It's definitely an inconsistency, and it's an old story. But I still think the premise is great. So you could tell that the filmmakers read this and were like, "Man, there's so much cool about this. Like, we just have to change the Green Knight to be a little more existential than what he is in this story. Because in this story, he's kind of like a trickster that teaches a moral. But in the A24 Green Knight, he's like something else entirely, which I want to talk about, but not get ahead of myself. I mean, I guess we can hop into that. Like, he's supposed to be death, essentially, right? Like, in this movie, the Green Knight is like the Grim Reaper, kind of. Is that... That's the take I got from the movie. I don't know what you guys got.
I didn't take that. I took it as like a symbolism of courage. Like, that whole thing was Gawain, Garwin. I don't know what to say. I'm going to say Garwin because that's what you guys have been saying. It reads like Gawain, doesn't it?
I thought it was Gawain.
Or Garwin, whatever. Anyway, Dev Patel's character. I thought this was kind of like a quest for him to get honor, because that's what he wants to be. Like, they ask him, why does a knight do what he does for honor? But in order to get that honor, you need like a semblance of courage to be a knight. You know what I mean? So, and I really liked when he faces the Green Knight at the end, and Green Knight's ready to deal his blow. He's ready to hack. That's what he says. And then he flinches. And then the Green Knight's like, you flinched. That was hilarious. I cracked up at that. And he's like, you flinched. And Green Knight says to him, you had a whole year to prepare. So that whole year, that's what he was supposed to do. He's supposed to get that courage to take that blow. So that's kind of what I took for it. But Sir Gawain said this. He's like, 1 year, 100 years, it's not going to give me the courage to die like that.
Which was a bar when he said that. I was like, wow.
Hold on. Let's settle it so we don't mess up this podcast.
Gawain?
Gawain.
I mean, that's Google.
Sir Gawain.
Sir Gawain.
But that's just the American pronunciation. What's the British one?
Do they have ye olde English?
Gawain.
Gawain.
Sir Gawain.
Sir Gawain.
So, I still maintain that I see the Green Knight as death, and I'm not sure if there's a right or wrong answer. I'm sure Sheldon's watched 30 analysis videos by now. So
I only read what you read. I read that probably like three times that night, and when you told me that you thought it was Grim Reaper, I'm still sold on that.
Yeah.
Because it made the most sense because he essentially is an immortal being.
Yeah. I'm just going to back it up with a few things that like I've noticed from the movie. So, you know, the green sash is given him by his mom. And that's kind of, to me, allegorical of what mothers give to their
what
children.
What green represents.
Yeah. But more importantly, it's like mothers give to their children life. And so like that's what he gets from his mom.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's wearing this thing, this life, you know what I'm saying? And it's so precious to him. And I mean, there's so much that symbolizes that it's life. Like even the whole sex scene was very symbolic of that, in my opinion. And the only way that he dies is if he literally gives up life. If he takes this thing that his mom gave him, which is his existence, and he casts it aside.
Yeah.
As long as he keeps it, you know, he can't be hurt. That's what his mom says. So, you know, he has this green sash on him, and there's this really ingenious scene where he runs away, but he doesn't. Spoiler alert, he doesn't really run away. The whole scene that precedes him running away from the Green Knight is actually in his head. And it projects the horrible, awful future that awaits him. Whereas, you know, he abandons his true love. He gets a kid. He marries royalty, and he's just in this really insane situation where everybody abandons him. In my mind, because they know that he cannot die. They know that like what the horror that is befalling the castle as it gets sieged is so terrible that they need to leave. But he's in no danger because he cannot die. So he takes the green sash off, which is him being like, to be immortal is a curse. To be immortal is not like what we're all afraid of dying. But the thing that's even more horrifying is to live forever. And so he takes the sash off and his head falls, which is a foreshadowing of what's about to happen to him. And so then ingeniously, he snaps back into the present moment. And at this point, when I'm watching the movie, I was so emotional because I was like, dude, like that really is what dying feels like. It's like, I don't want this to happen, but it has to, you know, and it's just part of the thing. And if I accept it and I just face it with open arms, then it's going to be better. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as he gets that attitude,
gets the acknowledgement from
the Green Knight, the Grim Reaper himself smiles. Like he actually makes death himself smile, which is a pretty deep moment in the film. And I was literally shook, like as soon as the title, the end card happened, because I was like, that makes me think about my own demise in a way that was very artistic. Yeah. So that's what I got from the movie.
So
that was a really nice takeaway.
One thing that after I've read the poem or the original story, that foreshadow, I'm pretty certain, is in line with the original story. He goes back home, tells them of his tale. What happened in the movie? When he tells them of the tale, they're all just like, oh, whatever. And then they all start wearing the green sash, just like in this in the story. So he saw what his life was going to be like, and that's how, which was cool, even though he did change the ending, he still kept the original writing in the story of, like, this is what his life is going to become, a 15-minute no dialogue, just montage of what his life's going to be. And then, like you said, that moment when after his head fell and we're like, damn, what an ending to a movie, and then it shots back to the time, and the Green Knight's about to do it, he's like, wait.
He takes it off.
Yeah. He's like, okay, I'm ready. And, and like, that steel resolve he had, dude, that right there was like, that made the movie for me.
Yeah, man.
There were so many moments before that movie where I was like, this is like one of the ones, dude, sitting next to him, I sat up a couple times like, where's this going? I was like, okay, I'm here. I'm like, this is interesting. And I couldn't figure it out. And then the one thing I wish that he might have kept the same was when he changed, or I wish he kept the same as the original story, was the king and the queen.
Okay.
With the gifts, the exchange of gifts.
Mm.
So I think a lot of people might not understand what that king was trying to receive from Galwyn or Galwyn when he said, oh, he knows that his wife is alluring. He knows that his wife is essentially a cheater. He's like, whatever she gives to you, give to me. And so in the story, that's what the kisses, he was giving him the kisses and stuff. So in the movie, it makes it seem like, you know, he was maybe, you know, in the closet or something like that. Whereas I perceived it as he knew that this guy defeated the person that can't be defeated. He wants to be a part of his story.
Mm.
He has no story himself. He's just a rich guy in a castle and his wife who doesn't want to be faithful.
Yeah.
And his mother, whoever. He's like, he wants in on the story. If he dies, he wants to be a part of Sir Gawain's story.
Yeah.
So that's when he was like, I need something from you. Because every time he was around, he was just so enthralled with him.
Right, exactly.
It was, that movie is just so good.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point too, but so I really, really like that death aspect, but the more that I keep thinking about how I thought it was about courage, so that the green sash, so if you wear the sash, you're protected, you can't get struck down. So the way that I seen it was that if he wears this, it's a safety net, so that means like he can't fail. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So if he wears this thing, there's no way he can fail. And like, it's like saying like you're getting through life with like the safety net. It's like you're not really gaining any experience. You're just moving right along. So like it kind of reminds me, and it sounds pretty funny on the Switch. Perfect example. If you play Final Fantasy, you can hit this button and you become ultra powered. You can just kill all the enemies.
God mode, yeah.
So like you're not getting any experience or anything like that. You can't die. It's like, what are you learning? What are you gaining? Mm-hmm. Are you having? It's not even fun. Blah blah blah. So he is confronted by the fox. And remember, I don't know if you guys remember, before he gets on the boat to the Green Chapel, the fox starts talking. Yeah, and they're like, don't go, blah, blah, blah. He's like, I have to go. And the fox like, why do you wear that sash? And he's like, oh, it's a gift. You know what I mean? But Garwin knows that if he wears this, he can't die because he is terrified to go there. He's terrified to face the Green Knight. And the fox like, then leave the sash there. He's like, no. And he's being real real hesitant to do it. He doesn't want to do it because he knows that he'll be protected because he believes in witchcraft because his mom is the witch. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah. So I think that great example where we're seeing like in his vision that he has what happens if he runs away from the Green Knight. And he's basically living a lie then because no one knows that he ran away. Everyone at that castle probably thought that he fought the Green Knight and won if he came back alive.
And he tried telling him and they didn't believe him.
Yeah, so he's just like living a lie, and the lie is manifested in this sash. Like it's like a, again, it's that safety net.
It's like
net.
A Pinocchio nose.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
And then he finally took it off, and then what happens if he didn't wear it? He would have lost his head, and then he finally took it off and then lost his head.
I feel like the film in the beginning has like a very sort of story approach, and then it transitions into like intensely allegorical as like,
oh yeah,
as if you're almost reading like some old text, because there's just some part that there's parts that you're just like, okay, why is no one mentioning the woman that's blindfolded? Like they're like ignoring her presence. Like it transitions from something that's like story driven into almost like you're reading a book.
Yeah.
But it like does it like very, very slowly.
Yeah.
It took me to the second watch to realize that that was the mom the whole time. I didn't pick that up at first. I didn't think it was.
It's the mother of the two people who own the mansion.
I think it was the mom. I think she like...
So that's how it was in the original story.
Yeah. Okay. I think it was.
That's how it was in the original story.
Yeah, she blindfolded herself. And she's the one who summoned the Green Knight. Like, I think she is the one who set this whole thing up to teach Sir Garwin, like, this... Like, what it takes to be a knight. What it takes to, you know, develop courage. I guess, to be a knight. Like, this was all, like, her... big plot. And the king, I guess he was in on it. I think so, because the original text that Andrew just read, like he was the Green Knight essentially. So was he in on it the whole time, like the film version? I don't know.
I don't think so in the film version, but I think they still kept the mom's role somewhat intact to it.
In the movie, it's like the Green Knight is very invasive to Arthur's Round Table. Like the queen literally gets possessed. Like it's not something that they're in on at all. Like it's just something that they've been taken by storm. So I think the filmmakers make a very clear distinction that like they're not telling the original story. Like the Green Knight is not an inside job, at least not on behalf of the Round Table. Like he is something that just comes in and is super invasive. And, you know, Godwin's like eager to prove himself. And so that's why he does what he does. It's rash. Like me and Sheldon, when we were watching it, we like cringed when his head got cut off because I was like, oh, you could have just cut like a little piece of him off.
We were just like, listen to what the guy said. Yeah,
exactly. But like, so that's why I see Ant's point pretty clear with what he did, because it does seem to be a story about courage, because he could have done anything to him, but because he wanted to be great like the people around him, like he mentions in the movie, he thinks it's going to make him look tough to kill this like creature that can't be killed.
Even when the Green Knight said to him, he said, I shall return one blow. Mm-hmm. Let it be a scratch, let it be a poke.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, and then our boy was just like, fuck. he's like, chopped his head off, man.
What did Gaiman say? He's like, remember what happened here this Christmas Day? So I guess that was him like trying to, you know, throw that bravado on to assert this greatness or this knightness.
I thought there was another thing, another theme I picked up after like reading it again was in the movie sense, like he avoided his fate twice. The first time he avoided his fate when he was tied up, and then he was against a tree, and then time was going forward, and then it came back to him, and you saw that he was died. If he accepted his fate, he was going to die.
Yeah.
So then the camera went the exact same route, came back. And then he's like, nah, I don't want that. And then that's when he got out.
Yeah.
The other time he didn't accept his fate was the end of the movie.
And then the flash forward.
I thought that was so geniusly done.
Yeah. And like, I don't know if you just mentioned it, but like it's like very reminiscent of like that thing, like that, what was it? It was like a picture diagram that was like spinning.
To show the seasons.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It kind of reminded me of that. But there was one scene I wanted to rack your guys' brains on. So it was, I think it was when he first got into that castle with the guy and the girl.
Okay.
And it showed that painting of them chasing the fox. Yep. I don't know if you've seen it. It was like a quick scroll.
Yep.
And then like, I don't remember what happened before the next shot of it came up. But then like, it was like an opposite like pan of the guy chasing Sir Gawain. So like first like the fox was getting hunted, and then the next time they showed it was Sir Gawain getting hunted. But like, what was the significance of that? I still don't know.
Well, that's interesting. But a fox, you know, during this time, that was considered elusive, a prize. If you could catch a fox, you could like maybe catch anything. I don't know. Like, foxes are hard to catch.
They're quick.
So they're quick. And so in some way, did maybe our guy Gawain represent a fox somehow? Like, because foxes are seen as what? When you think of fox, you think of like joyful, not responsible. You know, they're kind of a trickster. And Gawain essentially is a trickster. He was in the brothel in the start of the movie. He didn't want to have any responsibility, but he wanted to feel like he could be able to sit with the knights at a round table. But he felt like he didn't deserve to sit with the knights at a round table. So they had to schemize a way that could, where he would feel like he was welcome to sit here. Mm. So I don't know. But that is a good question. I didn't really look much into it. And I also didn't remember. I kind of forgot about that.
Maybe.
That there's a picture of the fox.
Yeah. Now that I'm thinking about it, I think it could be that. But I'm also thinking like maybe after that thing happened with his wife, like that sex scene. Mm-hmm. I use that very loosely. Maybe that hunter guy wanted to hunt Sir Gawain down because he wanted, like you guys mentioned earlier, he wanted to take whatever he takes from that house. And in that sense, it was like that brief little sex moment that happened. So it's just weird. Like, that guy is like just a hunter. I don't know like what the significance is in that, in the grand scheme of the story. Because there's like two other instances that happened. So like, the one is when the girl was like a ghost and then he had to get her head. Do you guys remember that one? He had to retrieve her head. What was up with that?
Again, like, my interpretation of this movie is that it is all about accepting death, and some people die in a way where there's not really a lot of clarity, or there's not really a lot of closure in their death, and that's like what happened to her. She was raped and killed, and so he kind of goes down the water and finds her remains and brings them up to the surface as kind of almost like a redemption, you know, that she's not forgotten or discarded as some sort of object, that she's treated as a person, as like an individual. And man, what a intense scene where he's holding the skull, gnarly. And then it shoots down to her, and he's holding like a real head. Dude, when I saw that, I was like, that is like, I've seen that in my nightmares probably at some point. Like,
oh my
God. Dude, that was so intense. Yeah. And you know, so
even the water scene was so
jarring. And again, I just think that's another character that like had to deal with death in a way that like Sir Gawain wasn't afforded. Like, He's afforded the opportunity to see his death and his fate as it is. Like, he can literally be like, it's going to happen in 1 year, which is sort of like a luxury in a sense. But her death, she met like a swift end. She met like a rape and a kill and just thrown into the water. So it was kind of for him to be like, yeah, there are other people that meet like really intense fates, and and it was more of like, I'm protected, you know, that's not going to happen to me.
What about the part when she said to him, he's like, are you ruining it? Or he's like, are you ruining it? She's like, what does it matter?
I mean, like, yeah.
Like, it's just like you said, like accepting the fate, like she was accepting. She said, I need you to get this so I can move on. And he's just like asking these questions. She's like, does it really matter?
Like, right, right. Because what happened to her, whether it happened or not, is like, it's still a sound theoretical question.
Yep.
It's like a sound theoretical idea about death. Like, even if she's real or if she's not,
yeah.
Like, the fact that some people can die that way, it's a perplexing question. Like, what about their fate, you know?
Yeah. But I also think that we also have to think in terms of the story of how this is his quest. So, like, we think that this is going to be his quest to become a knight. So, like, I'm thinking how it pertained to the quest, because before he jumps into the lake, or yeah, like the little body of water, he asks her, what do I get in return if I do this? And she's like, don't ask me that. Like, don't ever ask me that. Like, why would you ask me that? And then it made me think, like, was that his mom again?
No, to me, again, this is all my translation, and I'm literally pulling this out of, like, my perception of the movie.
One-time view.
Yeah, it's because, you know, like you said, it's his journey to become a knight, which is what the movie's about. But that part specifically was about chivalry and, like, what it is interacting with women. Like, knights don't defend women because there's something that they get in return. They do it because that's what a knight does.
Yeah.
That's why she was like, don't ask me that, you know?
See, now, okay.
Yeah.
Now you're making me remember things. The whole movie was essentially, he wants to be a knight, but he knows he's not a knight. And when the Green Knight says, you have honor, when you have honor, you're then a knight.
Mm-hmm.
So the chivalry with that girl, like, what not to ask a woman, especially, you know, a dead woman, then have an integrity with that family, and then the ending of having honor to face what you did a year ago. You have to, you know, do it again. So those are, like, essentially for him to become a knight.
Exactly.
Totally.
And so,
even if it meant losing
his
life.
I know you're ready to jump in, but I just want to establish something really quick. At the end of the movie, the Green Knight calls Gawain a knight, right?
Yep.
And in the beginning of the movie, when he's talking to that kid that's antagonizing him, the kid that later on robs him, remember? Mm-hmm. He's like, you're a knight. He goes, I never said that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So he goes from denying his destiny to embodying it. And that really is what this story is about. Yeah, so
that's a great point.
It's right. Like, it's about courage.
Yeah.
But yeah, he goes from not even identifying a knight to what I consider to be death or God, acknowledging that he is one verbally, which is like the highest honor. You know, so it's like he goes through all the phases possible, and by the end of the movie, he is a knight, you know?
Yep.
And a knight is somebody who is willing to die. Like, that's what a knight is. If you just go to the Philadelphia Art Museum and you look at the knight armor and you read about it, like, they were just throwing their lives away for the king and just smashing and hacking. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was their life.
Because essentially what he did to the Green Knight was on behalf of the king.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in order to become a knight.
Right. So
he got what he wanted, but it cost his life.
This is almost like an ancient military propaganda. That's almost what it is. Like something that you would tell to, like, a little kid who wanted to be a knight.
Yeah, and remember they were telling it, speaking of little kids, remember throughout the movie,
the
puppet show.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it is. It's like if your son expressed interest in wanting to be a knight in the Middle Ages, you'd tell him the story of the Green Knight to, like, let him know what to expect in terms of character.
Yep. The tale of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
Right. That's, like, something that, like, every knight would know, I guess, as they go into battle, you know? But yeah, that is what this movie's about. So
I'm actually seeing the whole house.
I'm seeing Ant's courage, like, point very strongly here.
Because, like, after he returned the head and she wasn't in there, then the axe that was stolen from him is magically there again.
Reveres,
So what do you think of the scene of when with the giants?
Dude, that's the one thing
I wanted to talk about. That.
Okay,
yeah.
So let me just be because I'm the quickest.
You can even ask him after the movie. Like, this is before going into the movie. I didn't know that this was, like, because they didn't specifically say it was King Arthur, right? So I didn't think of Camelot and, like, you know, England. Like, so, but I was picking up a lot of strong Norse mythology, especially once I got to the giants. In my head, I'm like, this is Jotunheim. So now you said to him at the end, he's like, I don't think so. And I was like,
what is that? I don't know what that is.
Jotunheim's the land of the giants.
Oh.
So that's what it made
like
me
Raftel
think of.
Like Raftel from One Piece?
Elbeth.
And then,
Elbeth.
And
what did
then,
I say, Raftel? Oh, that whoops. Yeah, Elbeth.
And then the Green Knight, that land that he is, it reminded me of, like, Elfenheim. Because the Green Chapel was all magical. It was a magical area.
Yeah.
So that's where I was like, Norse mythology. And then when I did research after it, and then I remembered, oh, this is, I was like, duh, his uncle's Arthur. I never put in my head King Arthur and that. They're sitting literally at a round table. It's like they're, as another genius way of telling you that this is a side story of King Arthur's story without telling you that this is King Arthur. So you're thinking Sir Gawain the whole time, the Green Knight, but he was a part of, like, King Arthur's, like, round table. Yeah. But you don't really realize it unless, like, you know.
Dude, I don't know anything about that. I don't know anything, like, King Arthur, the Sword in the Stone. I don't know anything about that.
Yeah.
it's like, it's in, I think the allure of that is super cool because it's like super old.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. I just never checked it out. I should.
Yeah. My take on the Giants is I have absolutely no idea anything that had to do with that scene. I'm just kind of mad that the trailer showed that for a glimpse because the whole movie, I was like, it's going to be a scene with Giants.
I was waiting for it.
I'm ready for it.
Dude, that's the worst with these new trailers, man, because, dude, that scene was so badass.
Yeah.
It was cool, but, like, I don't know why they were singing. I don't know why she was afraid to touch him because the fox was there. I don't know anything about that scene. That scene is completely, like, so, I have no idea.
So I am just as lost as you guys are, and then Ronnie got, like, some kind of interpretation from it from somebody else, and apparently it was another thing in relation to the quest where Gawain was like, can I ride on your shoulder? Like, take me where you're going. So that would have been another way for him to, like, shortcut, escape. Yeah. And that's, like, another allegory for no shortcuts.
But that part when him and the fox are walking and the camera's super far behind, and then I blacked out in the theater when that happened because I was just, like, watching him, and the camera just slowing so slowly, and I literally, like, was like...
Are you talking about the shot where it was rotating?
Yeah.
As he's walking
forward? I zoned out because I was just like... I just got so entranced with it. And then in my head,
the ground became the sky. Dude, that was crazy. Yeah,
dude, so as I'm watching it, I'm like, oh, dude, in my head, I'm like, I'm gone right now. Because I was like, where'd they shoot this?
Yeah.
Where'd they find this whole area from? Because this looks beautiful.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, is that a real fox? It looks CG, then it looks real. I can't tell.
No, okay.
And then it did that split second shot of something, and that's when it, like, brought me back. Mm. And I was like, then I said to him, I was like, did they just show something? And he's like, I don't know.
I had no idea.
So no, it's just like it goes upside down. And you know what that scene reminds me of? It reminded me of, I don't know if you've ever been, I'm sure you guys have been to Disney World or Disneyland, whatever one's in Florida. And they have that ride where you sit on the chair and like it lifts in the air. It's like you're on an airplane. Not an airplane, I guess, but something like that. And like your feet are dangling. And it's just like the seats move and blah 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 and they spray mist at you, but like the video shows like you like going over the sea and going over mountains. That's what I thought about
a 4D coaster, something like that. Yeah. Like a 4D roller coaster.
That's what I felt like I was on that ride. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, that scene was disorienting for me too. I loved it. There was a lot of times where Sheldon and I were watching the movie. I shouldn't say a lot. I'd say there was some pretty prominent moments where, like, first, him leaving the castle for the first time, I just looked at Sean and was like, this is going to be a good movie.
Dude, the
idea of him, he's also very picturesque. Like, the way that the set designers and the costume designers made him, how he kind of has this bold yellow, and it's just him with an axe, and he's being followed by a fox. He looks like a video game protagonist.
Yes.
And I, like, was really into that. I was this is really getting
And they let
the
scene breathe. Not a word was said.
No music or anything. Let it breathe.
You felt the weight of the journey. That's the thing. Like, there's a lot of waiting in this movie. That's why, like, it's not a movie I'm going to watch again anytime soon, because it's a very slow, like, day after Christmas watch. Mm-hmm. But, like, I was very much enthused by the way the filmmakers had you, like, have the weight with him. Like, you felt like you were going on the journey. Like, some scenes made you tired. And you're like, I feel like the journey. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. And, like, that's the thing about the trailer, too. Like, it made it seem like it was going to be this epic. And I'm not going to lie. That's what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be this, like, crazy badass movie fighting.
Like,
I thought
Lord
there was
of the
gonna,
Rings.
Yeah, it was going to be, like, a cool fight scene, but, like, it was a really pleasant surprise, in my opinion. So I think it totally diverted expectations. So I remember our buddy Alex was excited to see it. And then, like, as soon as that movie ended and I got out, I was like, did I overhype it? Is, like, not everyone going to get it? Like, in parentheses, like, everyone going to, like, understand what was going on? Because, dude, you show that trailer to anybody, it'll hype anybody. I'd be like, oh, this is going to be, like, a Lord of the Rings type deal, like a cool badass Night Tale. I mean, it was, but it wasn't like an action pack.
See, the one that got me into it, when I saw the Giants in the trailer, I was like, yeah, that's me. I was like, let's go. I was like, I'm here for that. Weird stuff, show me. I want to see it.
Yeah.
But funny thing to say that, so Drew and I went with Chris. Chris hated the movie. He didn't like it at all.
Boo.
Yeah, because I guess maybe from the trailer, because at the same time of the trailer shows it as, like, kind of an epic fantasy adventure.
Yeah.
But then you see the movie, and it's just,
drawn.
You and I mean, I think I speak for the three of us when I say, like, we're kind of, like, nerds, we're media heads, so like, we really get fanatical about, like, movies and songs and stuff like that. Like,
art.
That's
essentially
our
art, yeah.
That's our hobby, so, like, anybody who's a media and film enthusiast will like this movie. The casual viewer probably won't, and I understand that. Like, it's not a bad thing. If you don't like it, then the movie's not for you.
Totally,
like,
totally.
Especially when they're throwing a lot of themes and a lot of allegory at you.
Totally.
Yeah, and it's not like, oh, you don't like it, you're not smart. It's literally not what it is. Like, it's like, is this visual experience something that's, like, entertaining to you? If it is, then okay. Like, that's literally what it was. Yeah. I loved just the way it looked, the way it sounded. And, like, just little decisions. Like, when he finally finds the Green Knight, he has to wait till he wakes up, and it's, like, the most nerve-wracking thing ever. And there's a scene where, like, his eyes are open, and he sees that he's there, but he won't wake up.
But
he
it's just, not
like,
time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Dude,
yeah.
Yeah, like, just little stuff like that. I'm like, there's so much thought put into this movie.
That's
like,
one
I
of my favorite parts of the whole film. Because Dev Patel's sitting there with the axe, just, like, no sleep, just looking at him.
Yep.
Then the one night, because we, dude, and it was just panned on the Green Knight, and then he's just sitting there. And I, at first you couldn't even tell, and then his eyes opened, and he just looks at him. Then he just closes his eyes again, and he's like, it's not time yet.
Yeah,
it's
like
not
the
day.
He's like still half asleep.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
see,
so
that,
cool.
That's
he's,
to
like,
me,
he's like, oh, yeah. Dude, that was such a cool moment.
That to me was another death allegory where it's like a lot of people live their life in fear of, like, they're almost like, when is it going to happen? When,
yeah.
And like when they live like that, they get exhausted like he is. And then when it's time for them to go, they cling so tightly because they've been like, when is it going to happen? When is it going to happen? Like, that's why for me, that was another thing that drove that point home. Because death is sort of like that where it's like, everyone gets life, like everyone gets this experience, and just like you said, Sheldon, he goes, it's not time yet, and
not
then he closes his eyes and wakes back up, and then it's time. So it's like, if you look with anticipation, that stress and that fear is going to hit you, and that's what he did, you know. That's just how I saw it. But whether or not it was supposed to be that way, the reason I like this movie is because of so many little detailed choices like that. Like, even in the beginning where there's like this creepy narration and then his head
heads
catches
on fire.
I was immediately
sold me.
Yeah, I was immediately drawn
was
in. As soon as that happened, I was like, bro, I'm turning my phone off. Like, this movie is gonna movie's gonna get real.
And
I
then and then the part where it kept doing like the intro of, like, you know, the intro credits and then it cuts back to the scene and the guy's still sleeping there, but the building in the back's on fire. I'm like, what's going on?
Yeah.
I was like, what's going on here?
Exactly.
And then I'm thinking, this guy's our main guy.
Yeah.
And then it zooms in, and then our main guy's here. So I'm like, what's happening over here? Because this is interesting as well.
It's one of those movies where you hang on to every single word.
Everything.
And it's almost like, if I watch it again, I kind of want to watch it with subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
It creates intrigue at every turn. So it's like, you really are trying hard not to figure it out, but just to see what happens next.
And,
like,
and that's why the ending was so powerful, that literally it was 15 minutes of not a single word was spoken.
Yeah.
Bro, you know how hard it is to, like, sell a movie? Like, think about it. You're in the room, it's like, listen, ending of the film, not a person's going to say a word. Well, how long is it going to be? Like 30 seconds to a minute? 15. But, dude, they sold it so well. Even Dev Patel, his facial expressions, the anguish that he survived this. Then he lost his son.
Yeah.
And then, like, his wife and mother, by fact, or at least it looked like his mother didn't age at all. Mm. So she might be immortal. And then his wife just married in for the money. And she, like, when she was going to leave, she didn't say bye. She didn't kiss him nothing. She just got up very... Yeah. Whatever the word I'm looking for, and her design, and then left. And then he's just sitting there just like stewing. He's like, was it worth it to come to this conclusion?
I think the whole flash forward decision to have no dialogue was very intentional because he's projecting what his future is going to be in his head. And so he's not focusing on minutia like conversations.
Mm-hmm.
He's just focusing on main events. Like,
the events.
Exactly like what you would do if you projected your future. Like, you wouldn't think about the conversations in detail. Mm-hmm. You would just think about the beat-by-beat steps of your future. So that's why that scene is that way, because he's just imagining what would happen next. He doesn't know the details, you know?
Yeah, he essentially
that's why you
became
never,
a mad king, man.
Yeah, you never see the oppressive force that's closing on him in his castle, because it could be anything. It could be a dragon. It could be a giant.
Yep.
It could be an army of green knights. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. He's just imagining, like, in my mind, what it would be like to not die, like, you know. So it's just, that's why little details like that are super important to any movie. I mean, I'm not saying anything new when I say that with film and video, it's always show, don't tell. You never want to explicitly say why. You always just want to show.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie does that just beat by beat by beat. And that's it's awesome.
I agree.
You know?
I really like your guys' point, like, towards the end, when he does meet the Green Knight again and he's waiting. And there's no music. It's just the sound of the river and, like,
nature.
I loved even how the movie ended. Like, as soon as he does the thing. He's like, off with your head. And then it just says, the Green Knight. And there's no fanfare. There's nothing. It's just still like that quietness.
I think there's like nature sounds too. Mm-hmm. Something like that. Yeah, like a bird just tweeting. Birds which and, I think is awesome. Because it kind of underplays the whole sinisterness of the scene. I recently watched 1 Hour Photo with Robin Williams.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Yeah, it is great. But and it's funny because I watched the James review of the movie too. And
he
James
reviewed it?
Yeah, and James goes, they kind of shot themselves in the foot, like showing you how the movie ends in the beginning. But that's not really my focus here. My focus is that it's a great movie, but there's so much soundtrack. Like, there's so much music that leads the emotion.
Yeah.
And that's always why I've sung Vince Gilligan's praises on, like, Breaking Bad and stuff, because he allows for all the silence and tension. Mm-hmm. And, like, that to me is always the mark of, like, a really good movie, where, like, the moment that matters isn't aided by any sort of music. You yourself are allowed to feel how you feel about it. Without any direction. So that scene was the most important part. That's the whole reason why you're watching the movie. So for it to be as raw as possible, this is the only choice to have. Like, if there is music at all in that scene, it would be ruined because you're supposed to come to your own conclusion. Mm-hmm. So you provide your own soundtrack, for lack of a better term.
No Country for Old Men. Couldn't even tell you if there was much soundtrack to that film at all.
One
of the most suspenseful films you ever see because of the reason that they chose not to have a soundtrack to it.
Yeah,
that's what it just reminds me of.
Yeah, and you know, I think the best way to use soundtrack, and I hope we're not like completely shifting topics, is I can point out just two mainstream examples would just be like The Sopranos and Goodfellas, kind of like that Scorsese-esque, where the music that you hear is actually music that's playing in the building or in the scene. As it transitions, it goes from having like a room filter on it to just being full. So you don't even notice that, like, now it's becoming the soundtrack. It's left the reality of a room and it's become a soundtrack and it's like aiding the scene. It comes in and out naturally. So it feels like you entered a room where there's music and you left. That's the best way to do soundtrack, where every scene has a music that accompanies it, but is not consistent throughout the entire film. And stuff like Goodfellas and Martin Scorsese stuff, he uses a lot of copyrighted music. Like, he doesn't really score it. It's all like music that belongs to an artist. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's a lot of like Rolling Stones and things like that. But he also used like a lot of like 50s and doo-wop music. It's pretty cool.
The point is, like,
it's really signature of him.
Yeah, it fits into the period, and it's also used as a means of transition. It's never to actually tell you how to feel, because if you think about Scorsese films, a lot of the really violent scenes have like that happy, upbeat 50s music.
Yep.
So you're not supposed to feel happy about the violence. You're supposed to feel disturbed by the contrast, which is the purpose of the music. It's not to tell you how to feel, you know?
I think one of the biggest examples of that is Reservoir Dogs. So
stuck in the middle of
exactly. So Mr. Blonde's about to cut that guy's ear off, and then like the music's playing, the song's playing, and he goes outside, the music stops, and you just hear like the environment of the street, and then he goes to the trunk, gets the gasoline, whatever it is, and then comes back in, the music's still playing. It's crazy. That's one of the craziest examples I've seen of that. Because the song, like, you're in the scene and the song puts you even more in the scene.
Right.
And then you step outside and it's like, wait, that's still going on in there. That's a very, very dark.
Exactly. That's a perfect example.
And I think, like, you see examples of that, too, in, like, scary movies. Like, I think, like, one of the big cliches is, like, they'll play, like, a creepy song, like, in Insidious. It'll be, like, the Tiny Tim song, and, like, that just, like, you hear that, and you're like, oh, no, this could be in a scary movie. Mm-hmm. Things like that.
Yeah. But I'm a big fan in scary movies where it's just kind of, like, I don't know what movie originated this, but like the record catches or whatever, and it's just like an odd loop. You know what I'm talking about? I think that that's horrifying. Yeah. Even though at this point it's kind of cliche. I think maybe the first time I saw it was in Sinister, or the one where it's Strangers.
Sinister is definitely one of the scariest films.
I was
scary, but just gruesome.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that in years.
I was pretty scared when I saw that, but I've always thought that was an interesting choice to bring horror, just like something that's almost not music, but it's sound. It's like a loop that doesn't sound any melodic at all. It's just kind of disturbing how it keeps repeating.
Strangers did it too.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of creatively implementing music to boost a scene, not to tell you how to feel about it.
That's one thing that the horror genre struggles a little bit is sound design. Trying to figure out what's to let a scene breathe, and like you said, not give like the loud crash of audio from a soundtrack that like gives you the cue, like, this just startled you, now react to the scene. It's like, it's always got to be creative ways.
There was one, Insidious, I'm sorry to jump back to Insidious, but I remember when I first saw Insidious, There was one thing in the very beginning of the movie, and I thought, I'd never really seen it in a horror movie before. It was like the title screen came up, and it was a very, very strong...
Violent
screeching. I thought that was really, really clever. I've never seen that before, and that scared the crap out of me. I just thought that was
That's a good
scary.
One, too.
Yeah, it's also...
like very violent.
Mm-hmm. And then it just stops and cuts out, yeah.
Yeah, that's classic. That's you know? So... That really is classic. Yeah. There's a... We'll watch it after this, and anybody listening, just look up on YouTube analysis of the scariest scene ever, and it's a
Japanese film.
You saw it?
I did see it. I watched
If he watched it, he'd be freaking out because I know you so well, man. I know like what scares you, and you would be so freaked out by the scene.
Dude, it's what movie? I watched the movie.
There's no way that you're gonna remember.
It's a Japanese film. Oh my god! I just recently watched it too. I watched it a couple weeks ago.
You watched this movie?
Because I saw that video.
Dude, I did not want to watch it after seeing that scene because it was that freaky.
The woman in the shadow.
Yeah, it was that scary that I was like, I don't even want to watch this.
Japanese horror films are one of my favorites just because they're so good.
There's like a classic one.
Are you looking it up?
Did we go with a P?
I don't know, dude. Just
I know there's one classic Japanese horror movie that's called Audition. I'm really interested in seeing that one. I never seen that
one. He knows every movie.
I think it is
Audition. Is it Audition?
I think it's Audition.
I just know that like in Japanese horror, there's just like one classic. It's Audition. I actually watched a Japanese found footage horror movie like last year. It was awful.
It was awful.
Awful as in scary or awful as in like it was...
Just bad, dude. Crap movie. I did not like it. It was all spooky.
Cairo.
The movie's called Cairo. And oh my goodness, man, is this scene horrifying. But I didn't bring it up to change topics. I brought it up because, like Sheldon said, there's no sound design to the scene. There's actually nothing at all. You are strictly relying on your visuals to bring the horror.
What Cairo means is pulse. And I saw its name in pulse. Remember I said that? I think it began with a P. And
where can I watch the movie? The film.
I can watch it. I went on the deep internet and found it.
Yeah, you can probably find on the deep internet like a lot of things. Like,
I think it was gonna be like on a stream.
But you know what? Another movie that I rival with that scene for one of the scariest shots in the film. Even Pulse is a horror film, but this movie's not typically a horror film. Was Parasite, when the little boy was downstairs when he should have been in the kitchen, and because you remember the people,
the dude's head.
You see his eyes coming up the top of the stairs. Very slow. And the kid, think about when you're a kid. What's the scariest thing you do? When your parents are asleep and you go try to do something that like you shouldn't be doing, like getting a snack or something, when they tell you not to get a snack. And you hear noises and you can hear your heart beating here. When that kid just eating at the fridge and then he hears the door open, then he just sees
those bug eyes. Yeah, dude.
Just like that.
Yeah.
Just start coming up. Scared him shitless.
Yeah, that's a very human thing.
But that scene in Pulse is things that when we're kids, we always look in the corner of our room. Like when you have a hoodie hanging there or something and you're looking at it, you're like, you're just staring at it. You're like, can't tell, no, that's not a person.
Oh, man, I remember one time I was sleeping and, well, I was trying to go to sleep and then like...
Here comes the scary stories.
My room was in the basement and then my door was open and this was when I used to sleep with the TV on because I used to not want to sleep in the dark and I get older and you get over that. And then I could see out my my door, like you could see the steps going up the stairs, and then like where like the railing was, there was like a little post that holds up the railing, and then like I looked over and it looked like a dress or something, like in the dark, like it was white, and because the TV could like illuminate it more, I could see it more, and it scared the crap out of me. It was just the jacket on there, but dude, that scared the crap out of me.
It's always a jacket.
Trick of the mind.
Yeah, man.
Cairo, man. Cairo, or in English, Pulse. That movie is phenomenal.
Is it worth the watch?
Yes.
Could you get a little closer to the mic? Sorry, man.
Yes, it is worth. It's worth the watch. I was just reminiscing like of the movie.
What's it about? Spoiler-free synopsis.
It's like they move into this home. It's always like it's a home thing. It's always like a home thing, but. Yeah, I don't want to give too much because I really just want you to see it. Like, no expectation, just go in and watch it.
Yeah.
But I did see Audition a while ago. That's also a visceral movie. That movie's crazy.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you guys happen to see it, but one of my favorite the zombie movies was Train to Busan.
Never heard of it.
You talk about that movie all the time.
All the time.
You love it,
dude. Because like I love zombie films, and it's like they're never good. My favorite zombie film ever is Dawn of the Dead, 2004, Eli Roth. I think Eli Roth did it. I would have to check the DVD when I get home. And that movie, no, it wasn't Eli Roth. It was, who did Batman vs. Superman?
Snyder?
Snyder, Zack Snyder.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean,
that movie's so good. It shows the true essence of, like, if zombies could sprint, what would it be like? And it's not fun. And then Train to Busan is like, it's on the train heading to Busan. But it's actually a really good movie.
Like, I think, yeah, like with the zombie genre, like there's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
I think when zombies run, when they have the ability to run, that's really scary.
That's what I'm saying. So then that's now take it on a train.
Yikes.
And it makes it.
I feel like everyone has different aspects of the zombie genre that they like. Like, I'm sure you like the survival element where there's like a group that's under equipped and they have to deal with the overwhelming mass of zombies, and little by little, like somebody gets cut off, like they, their numbers start to dwindle. Then they find, like, for me, I like the whole Robert Neville I Am Legend aspect of the zombies thing, where it's like there's one guy who's really smart and he has like a bunch of rigs and traps and explosives, and like it's just him out here and his dog. Like, I like that. I like kind of like the lone wolf. He doesn't really have anybody. Like, so like everybody, I feel like, finds something in the zombie genre that, is like a narrative or a story that they'd like to hear. And then some people don't really like it at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting how that, just like any other sort of horror genre, has resonated with us for so long. Like, even now, we're still making movies and books about it. Like, what is the fascination?
Dude, when there's horror movies on a farm, terrifying. You see them cornfields? Yeah. Horrifying.
Yeah, I think the whole psychology of fear on a farm or some sort of agricultural land, it's isolation, but it's also, there's not really a lot of places where you can hide. Yeah, like, that's the whole thing, where it's just kind of like, there's a clean horizon line, so there's not really a lot around you. And I think instinctively as humans, that gets us like on edge, because there's not really anything we could hide behind or under or around. And that's, you know, it's one of those uncanny things, like liminal spaces that just really freaks us out.
We still have to go see Candyman when that comes out in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting, that trailer. Yeah.
Did you just happen to see a trailer?
I did see. I know it's like a remake of like an old movie.
From Candyman from the 90s.
Yeah. I mean, frankly, I wasn't interested in it. I don't think I'm going to see it.
Candyman's one of those good ones because it's psychological.
Okay.
A good psychological horror movie is good. There was this one, I would have to get the name of it, but while I find that, I think I talked about it on this podcast before.
When you think of that, Back to Zombies, I remember I haven't seen a lot of zombie movies, but I've seen the original Night of the Living Dead. That's the first one, right? Like the very first one ever
made.
Very
first one.
I thought that was a really good movie. It was really well made for its time, too. And then I didn't even watch it. I watched one scene because I turned it right off after it. It was like a remake of it. And like the guy's like, dude, it was like in the 80s or the 90s, something like that.
Yeah.
And like the guy's visiting a grave, and then, dude, a zombie comes out and grabs him, and they're like wrestling. And the guy's like, dude, he falls down. He hits his head on a tombstone.
Yeah, that's how he dies.
But dude, it was a dummy, and you could tell it was a dummy. It was so funny. I turned the movie right off. I was like, I don't want to watch it.
The movie's called His House. Dude, give that a go on Netflix. It's this couple that moved to England. They fled, I think it was Sudan. They fled Sudan, and as they were leaving, they were kind of like cursed by like a local like thing.
Classic.
And the wife doesn't believe in it, right? But the husband like does. So like he thinks things are happening in their home. When it's like not, but it could be. So I'll leave it there. But it's like, dude, it's a really good film.
Interesting. Those it's like really house good. Horror movies are always, I mean, it's like the same old thing over and over again, but you got to do it differently. I watched one recently.
This one was really different.
Interesting. There was one I saw, I don't even remember the name of it. I watched it with my friend, and it was like a girl, she's a night nurse. She takes care of this guy. And he lives alone with someone, and it was like a really low budget movie, and he like takes and like she's like, you know, exploring the house and doing all these things, and while he's like sleeping, and then like he wakes up in the middle of the night and she has to put him back to bed, blah blah blah, and then like as the movie progresses, like more and more spooky things start happening, And like while I'm watching this movie, I'm like, this movie sucks. Like I'm so done with this. But we're so invested in the movie because we got this far. We have to see how it ends. Mm-hmm. So like it starts getting crazy, and then like a ghost comes out, and then like it's like the ghost of his daughter or something. Blah blah blah. And like I thought this movie sucked, but it ended really really well. So I don't know the. I can't really spoil it because I don't know the name of the movie. But this is how it ends, and I thought it was really really clever. So. It turns out that the dad, like the guy that the girl was taking care of, was her dad. And then, like, she runs out of the house because, like, the ghost is, or something is, like, trying to kill her. It's, like, some other little girl or something. It's, like, trying to kill her. But, dude, like, when she runs out, this is, like, something out of a dream. Like, she runs out of the house, and, like, her mom's there. And she's like, what's going on? Blah, blah, blah. And she, like, hugs her. And she's like, Mom, like, I'm so scared. Like, it was, like, such, like, a weird, like, whoa, what the fuck just happened? But, like, yeah. It was just so annoying how, like, the movie sucked leading up to that point. Yeah. And then, like, the ending payoff was, like, really, really, really good.
It's hard for horror movies to have a good ending. Exactly. A lot of them do not have a good ending. Well,
I feel like, I don't know, man. I feel like horror movie endings are just, like, irrelevant. Like, the whole point of a horror movie is just to scare you. And, like, it's hard to scare you with a definitive ending. That's why I think, like, a lack of an ending, a lack of closure, is the scary, most uncomfortable thing to leave somebody with. Which transitions into a question that, like, I wanted to ask you guys while we're on this topic. What's a scene from a horror movie that just haunts you, that, like, really sticks with you, that you think of, like, dang, that is something that, like, bothers me specifically? Because everybody's scared of different stuff.
I know one.
I have two. So, yeah, okay. let's go around and talk about that. I want
to hear both of yours first. While
the first one that comes to head is in Paranormal Activity when she gets dragged out of the bed. Dude, I remember I saw that in theaters, and I was like, wow. That really, really scared me. Because, like, dude, you're in your bed. You're just sleeping. Just imagine if something pulled you out of your bed. Horrifying.
I thought of one. What was your other one? Or did you have two?
I have two.
I think another one's another Paranormal Activity one. And Scream. Okay, so one is in Paranormal Activity 3 where the guy's, like, he turns on the light and all those old ladies are in there. That really, really creeped me out.
That's a badass ending.
Yeah. And then in Scream, it's in the beginning of the movie when it was Drew Barrymore, right? She was the actress in the first Scream. It was like a really early role for her. And then like her parents are out, and then the killer or Scream, Ghostface, whatever it is, chases her around, blah blah blah, and then he cuts her throat out, like she's out in the yard and she's like trying to scream for her parents who get to the door, but she can't because her vocal cords are cut. She's like and then the parents just go inside, and then that's really, really scary.
That's disturbing.
That's the definition of a hopelessness.
You already referenced the movie, but the ending of The Strangers, I remember when I first saw that, and the line still, I still think about it to this day. Remember when she says, why are you doing this? Because you were home.
I actually think about that all the time.
I think about, that is one of the most terrifying sentences ever. Yeah.
That movie is,
because she just looked at her blood on the mat, she's like, because you were home.
Yeah, that movie is pretty
terrifying.
Good. I need to rewatch that.
So yeah, just the first one, not the sequel.
There was a sequel?
Yeah. Always a sequel.
I remember when that came out, it was like the big draw of that movie, back to the music thing, was like there was no music. And I think like that was like one of the selling points too. Like it was like a quiet movie or something like that. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I recall that.
There's so much about that movie. People say it was like based on the Manson murders. Like I don't know what's true about that movie when it comes to the background, but I just like the idea of it. Like it was very much like Funny Games, if you've ever seen that.
I was just about to reference
that.
It's
a very similar premise.
I was about to watch it. It's on HBO Max, but it's the German version.
Don't watch the German
version. Yeah, I want to watch the English one. Yeah.
The German one's not bad, but that remake is so much better.
It's just better for an English speaker, but this is something that I think I've talked about Funny Games before on this podcast. What is amazing about that film is that it's not just a remake, the English version, it's a shot for shot remake.
Yeah, you guys are saying
meaning that,
that
every single shot's been remade
in the exact same
framing and everything. It's really awesome. But real quick before we segue into something else, the two scenes that stick with me the most, this, you guys are going to laugh at the first one, but definitely when I was younger it had an effect on me. In The Shining, where there's kind of a glimpse at the ghosts of the partygoers and the ones dressed up like a bear.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
Dude,
I don't know why
that bothered me so much, man. But, like, when I first saw that and, like, the guy looks, like, the other guy that's about to get, like, a blowjob from this bear and, like, looks down the hall, that was horrifying to me. And then we already talked about Sinister, but there's the fourth home movie or the third home movie in the film that he's watching, and the guy runs over a dude with a lawnmower. Mm-hmm. You remember that scene?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep,
dude, that bothered me so much. I remember like watching that in the theater. I was like, I'm not gonna be able to sleep just because of that scene. Yep. Like, that was so crazy, man.
It's dude, graphic.
Like, remember? It's weird what stuff sticks with us specifically.
Bro, Final Destination 3, when it was amusement park one, I didn't want to go to amusement park for a while because that was always in the back of my mind. It's like, what if this derails? And then that movie played on that fear.
Yeah, Final Destination is a different sort of fear. Mm-hmm. I think it's more of like a practical fear. Yeah. Like, that's kind of more of a worry fear. Whereas a lot of horror movies kind of have this almost like spiritual demonic thing that chases you. Final Destination is just like, what could go wrong in modern occurrence? Like going to a flying in a plane. Yeah. Going to so that's like a whole different genre of horror. It's almost like horror realism, you know.
Even though it's not like scary, but I thought it was one of the greatest moments. And it's back to Funny Games, but the part when something happens, you said you didn't see it, right? Okay, and then he grabs the remote.
Yeah,
like I'm just like, all I can do is like applause because that just breaks the viewer's perception. All
right, I'm gonna definitely watch it.
I'd be curious to think about to hear what you have to say about it specifically, just because I feel like your tastes in movies, at least years prior, like earlier, were very much kind of like the torture captor kind of movies. This is an interesting take on that genre.
Yeah,
it's a very interesting take on that. Kind of hostile whole genre. Yeah. This is a very nuanced
because it came out when Hostel was hot.
Yeah,
it came out during that time.
I don't know what it was. I just think that whole depravity was just so fascinating. And then like as you get older, like I watched a movie recently. It's called Bone Tomahawk, and it's a cannibal horror movie. It's a Western cannibal. As silly as that sounds, and then like even like as I get older, like the depravity and like the maiming of people, just like so, like how could you find like an entertainment value out of that? Yeah. Like I just feel like when I was younger, I was like, oh, Hostel, like this is crazy, like Saw, like wow, like I can't believe this is happening. But then like as I'm older, I'm kind of like people are like they're paying money, you know what I mean, to watch this, and it's just like it's such a crazy thing, like that morbid curiosity, that morbid fascination, like. Mm-hmm. It's just crazy, man. It's crazy that people think like that and people get entertainment out of that. It's just so scary.
Another Eli Roth classic, Cabin Fever.
Oh,
like that's another one, like, when the faces. Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
seeing
yeah.
Seeing skin peel off.
Yeah.
That's not a nice scene.
It's not, yeah. You know what I mean? That was like, a good movie. That was a good movie.
I mean, these are the type of movies that you watch almost as an experience. These are what I would label as experience films where you don't watch them by yourself. You watch them with other people, and they exist for you and your friends to go, whoa, that was crazy.
Like, shock value.
That's a way better way of saying it. Like Human Centipede. That's like they all fall under that category where it's just like,
sure,
this is a weird thing that exists. And the people who make these movies know that like it's so weird and crazy. That's the reason why people are going to see it. It's not something that like you watch once a year. It's something you pull out to shock people.
And
that's the whole point of these movies.
And then it's also the taboo of the film. It's like,
totally.
Film gets banned. It's like, dude, I just got this film.
Totally, man. Yeah.
There's a something that came out. We were talking about it with like Alex Carroll like a few months ago. It was a meme for a little bit. It's like the iceberg theory. So it's like tip of the iceberg, middle iceberg, and then below the iceberg. And they you'll have it with like anything.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah. So this one was for horror movies, and it was like your vanilla horror movies like Scream.
Sure.
Blah blah blah. Middle, it gets more. Darker, like it'll be like Scream, Hostel. Serbian film, and dude, it goes lower and lower and lower, and it gets very, very, very depraved, to the point where it's reaching snuff, and it's literal snuff. And there's a video, someone like went through the list and like they didn't watch all the movies because they couldn't get access to it, but he was like exploring different like message boards to get the information. And it was just crazy, like the stuff that like people make and like what you have access to. It's just like so crazy.
Yeah.
And I don't know where I'm going off on this, but I think it goes back to that shock value. Because like if you want that, you will like seek it out. And like that's why we go to the movies. Like that's why we go on roller coasters. Like we want that thrill. We want to be scared. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean. Dealing with fear voluntarily helps you deal with it involuntarily. Yeah. I think that's kind of why people are eager to be scared. It's just like you master that emotion in a sense.
know? It's crazy, like seeing that in like an entertainment thing. Like, one of my favorite horror movies is Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original one.
That's so, I had no idea that that was one of your favorites.
It's one of my first favorites. One? Yeah, one? Dude. Yeah, watch it. That movie holds up because you see like the gruesome side of it. Like, aside, you're seeing like a depraved and like mentally ill. Family. Psychotic family. Like, could you imagine being like a captive in that? Like, that is just like a nightmare in itself.
One of my favorite horror movies. So well done. House of a Thousand Corpses.
Oh my gosh, it's one of my dude! Favorites. So good, so good. Didn't you watch that recently?
That was the Rob Zombie.
Yes, one, right? Yeah.
See, I was not a fan of that movie. Really? I think it's more of a product of its time. Like, I couldn't really watch it and get into it.
It's hard to watch it. Certain horror movies don't hold up.
I think, like, that one holds up really well.
I do too.
I was like praying for it to end. That's why, like, I brought up, like, what scares you guys or what do you guys think is notable? Because for me, like, that movie was just, it was nonsense. Like, literally, that's what that movie was to me. I was like,
it's just like shock value.
I was like, I don't get it. I don't understand what's happening here. Like, I just know it's a classic, so I respect that, like, so many people hold it in such high esteem. But
I think it's more of a cult classic.
That's what I think. Like, I don't, you know. But I understand people that, like, watch Donnie Darko and they're like, what is this? Like, to me, I love that movie. But I completely understand somebody watching it and being like, this is just pretentious garbage. And I'd be like, maybe.
You Memento. Know, like, Memento. I love that movie, but a lot of people are like, what the hell is this shit?
Yeah, so I get it. It just wasn't my thing. I'm amazed that so many people love it, though, I do have to say.
But that's also what makes a film a film, you know? If it gets a visceral reaction, positive or negative, it gets people to watch it.
I think there's just different things that people find entertaining. Like, there's different things that resonate with people. Yep. There's nothing in that movie that resonated with me. I didn't like the music. I didn't like the actors.
It was so macabre. It was like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like, times, like, 100. And, like, there's that market. Like,
I love
people
the 2003
that.
Remake, though. I love that movie.
I remember I used to watch that with, like, my cousins. We used to watch that.
Really?
I think it's because how it was shot. It was just shot so, I don't know what the word I'm looking for, just like,
it was grime.
It was different.
Yeah.
It was
There's
different.
Like a scene in the movie where all these filters happen, and it's I was like, what is going on?
Yeah.
I was watching it like, all right, this is like where I check out. That was like my turn off the movie moment.
Saul did
with
it too,
the dummy.
When they would like cut someone's foot, and then they're just like,
it was just
all
like
these
all
weird,
these, like,
crazy shots.
Like, avid Final Cut filters. I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah.
So for me, I don't know. That really took me out of it. Yeah. I am kind of a fan of the movies where you're supposed to be a silent witness, where it's almost like not a show anymore. Like, that's the type of movies I feel like I'm drawn into.
Okay.
Not that every movie has to be like that.
Yeah.
I just felt like that was exactly like Ant said. It was macabre, shock value, like more of a spectacle. Something that would have resonated with me perhaps when I was younger, but I think watching it at my current age, I couldn't really appreciate it.
Do you guys have a favorite genre of horror? Like, if you could choose one.
I think psychological horror is the
psychological?
Most part.
Psychological?
Yeah.
Is your favorite? What about you, man?
I did at a time really like the gore